Welcome to The Geek in Review, the podcast focused on innovative and creative ideas in the legal industry. I'm Greg Lambert, and Marlene's traveling this week, so you got me again going solo, but I think we got a really exciting guest on with us, and we kind of pulled him in at just the last minute because there's so much going on with companies integrating some of the GPT 3.5 tools or ChatGPT into their products. And I went on a kind of a little rabbit hole adventure this morning, tracking down some things and something that Dennis Kennedy on his podcast had mentioned with Tom Miles. And there was a site that basically took the GPT and allowed it digest books, and then it allowed for a chat interface with the book itself. And so I was having all kinds of fun with that. I posted some stuff on Twitter, and I said, hey, wouldn't this be great if, you know, Lexis and Westlaw were to take their treatises or take their monographs or to take their practice guides and put this type of interface on it so that you're not just doing a Boolean type searching on it, but you're actually doing something that librarians were trying to get established 20 years ago, and that is to just use plain language searching. And I'm drawing a blank on the term natural language searching. So natural language searching. It seems like after 20 some odd years, we've kind of figured out how to do that through the AI. I'm joined by Colin Lachance, who is the co-founder and CEO of JurisAge AI in Ontario or in Ottawa, although he is joining us from beautiful Salt Lake City today. So Colin, thank you for coming on here. And I know we're going to talk some of the stuff that you're doing as well, and it's really exciting.
Yeah, great. Thanks very much. Big fan of the show.
Thanks. Well, and you were on, I believe you were on my In Seclusion podcast years ago, right at the beginning of the pandemic. So this is not your first rodeo here. So
it is not, although I do miss your Brady Bunch backdrop.
That was fun. Well, first of all, Colin, before we dive into some of the really cool stuff that you're doing there at JurisAge, give us a little background on how you found yourself co-founding yet another legal tech company there in Canada, this time JurisAge. So give us some background.
Sure. Thanks, Greg. So JurisAge is looking to deal with what we call the second biggest legal research problem. If search is the first, then engagement with the content and synthesis and understanding of the content is the second. We came about this in a roundabout but logical way when we look at it historically. I've been working in legal information and tech since 2011. I was CEO at Canley, Canadian Legal Information Institute. And then in 2015, I left, started working in different aspects of legal tech. In 2016, I started a company called Compass, which was built around a case law database that a small independent publisher in Canada who was shutting down was making available. And that gave us a chance to start working with Canadian case law with a view to doing what it is we're doing right now. So I'm only 6 years off schedule from why we acquired this database and the relationship with the courts to continue to receive content. That company had built a key number system, a really robust taxonomy over its decades of operation, 150 topics, detailed case digests, and so on. It modeled, you know, going back decades off the West key number system, but its own made in Canada version. Mm-hmm. So our view back then was, this is a great foundation for natural language processing. You have these beautifully editorially tagged items. So I'm going to skip over a bit of the history. We may have an opportunity to come back to it. Yeah. You know, up to 2020, I started a nonprofit with a view of saying, what happens if I let more people play with this data? If I start putting it in more hands at academics and, you know, other companies and so on, and let them explore for non-commercial purposes. And this is where I first met my partners inside the founding of JurisAge. It was an applied AI company called Alta ML. They do AI machine learning proofs of concepts for governments and large companies and so on. And they wanted to explore legal. So after a little bit of exploration, they said, oh, this is amazing. We want to do something with it. How are we going to go about getting the data and the domain expertise. And so that led to conversations that ultimately led to a joint venture. Between Compass and Alta ML, we created JurisAge as a joint venture.
Okay.
So that was a concept, but a concept without a purpose, you know, other than we knew there was stuff to happen in legal. So we came up with a name first before we even decided what we were going to do. Casting out for a good name. It's going to be something in legal intelligence. And in terms of figuring out our focus, we spent a lot of time talking with knowledge directors, law librarians, law partners, students, associates, and so on, just to explore the range of challenges that they had in dealing with legal research generally and case law specifically, mm-hmm. in order to find an area, an opportunity for us to engage. And so that's what led us to the point of believing that not only could we create something with the chocolate and peanut butter aspects of what we could bring together, their machine learning capabilities, our data, my domain expertise, but we were getting some strong signals from the market as to where there were some gaps that we thought we could work.
Okay.
That's how we started.
Okay. And I brought you on here because as I was raving at some of the possibilities of what the AI could be doing, you actually pointed out to me, it's like, you know, hey, we're already doing it here. So tell us a little bit. You have a subset of JurisAge that you call MyJr, MYJR. And rather than me trying to explain it, I'm going to let you explain what it does and what the inspiration was behind your creation of it.
Yeah, thanks. So MyJr was the idea of saying, well, what does a junior associate do other than, well, not other, but a significant function of a junior associate is to bring forward its research output to its partner. The partner might be going to argue the motion, but the junior associate has done the work.
Right.
But who's helping the junior associate? So what it does is a group of capabilities is it analyzes the case law in the background. So that way, when you get exposed to case law, whether you're on an existing legal research site like a Westlaw, Fastcase, Casetext, what have you, or on a Google Scholar or Justia, or in Canada, Canly, when you see a citation, all of those tools will offer you the ability to click the link and open a new tab.
Right.
Click the link and open a new tab. So you can imagine if you're reading a court opinion and it cites 10 more court opinions, you run the risk of opening many, many, many tabs. So what we do within MyJr is we, having analyzed the case behind using, you know, various machine learning and NLP, you know, magical things,
right.
and not so magical things, is we create a view into the insights that's behind that link. So you can hover over the citation on your page, get a little pop-up and explain what's there. If you want more information without actually reading the case, you can go to a more robust dashboard, where we've broken down more information, including recommendations on related cases by content, related cases by citation graphs, and so on. And what we're adding in going live for our, what we call our pre-sale users next week, is the conversation, the chat with the case. So essentially what you've described at the top of this call on engaging with a book, that's what we're introducing. It's having MyJr serve in place of your classmate or colleague to ask the question. So in the matter of Smith v. Jones, you might ask your colleague who's read the case before, what did Smith argue? And your colleague would tell you what Smith said. Well, okay, what did Jones argue? So this is what the MyJr function inside our offering does.
Okay.
You just ask, what did Smith argue? What did Jones argue? Explain this to me like I'm a 10-year-old.
So you just give it plain language and it gives you hopefully a plain answer, right?
That's right. That's right. And so it does use the GPT technology. So in this case, it's the DaVinci 3 mm-hmm. API and the GTP 3.5. Although the way we've structured it, having done a lot of the underlying analysis of the content organization, we put what you might call guardrails or context around the engagement. So this means when the question is being asked, the answer can only come from the content and not from the universe of language.
Okay.
So the universe of language, what these language models are great at is they're great at summarization, they're great at classification. What they're not great at is answering general questions when specific knowledge is important to the answer. So we try and address that by limiting its context. So your question is about the content of the case, but the properties of the language models allow you to ask it in whatever way makes sense for you, and it comes back in a very clear and digestible way.
Okay. Just to make sure I understood that, it's basically the GPT version is interpreting just the case?
Correct.
And then applying the answer on that. So it's not doing any type of general knowledge that it's bringing back in, which it's really good at making stories, but it's not necessarily really good at creating the truth based on actual facts, right? It will make stuff up if you don't limit it like the way that you're doing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the way we've tested the quality of its responses and the accuracy of its responses is just lots and lots and lots and lots of prompts where the only correct answer has to be something very specific. So that would include things like, what was the legal test and what is the authority for that test?
Okay.
There's only one way to answer that correctly inside the scope of the document.
Okay.
Now, there may be many ways to say it, but the answer has to be the test is X and the supporting authority is Y. Or so that's letter Y, not the question Y.
Right, right.
But the nature of how it comes back allows us to validate it. We can go back into the body and say, is this correct? Was this correct? And so we try, you know, a variety of things. And actually, we're currently hiring prompt engineers to really push the limits of this to both find what great questions will result in great answers and to find out what kind of things can result in incomplete answers.
Okay. Yeah, that's, I know there are complete Reddit groups out there that talk about the prompting. Some of them good, some of them evil, but it is how you structure and ask the question of the AI that really influences the answer that you may get back. Let me dive in just a little deeper, if you don't mind, and that is, are you setting it up to train the GPT version, or are you doing it kind of on the fly? Are you inserting the case as the question is being asked, or are you setting up a model on the back end that's actually training on your data?
It's a bit of both. Okay. The model is trained on our data. So we've been looking at different generations of language models, probably going back 2 years now from that first initial experimentation from Alta ML working with it. The early versions were, the results were uninspiring.
Yeah.
But we could find areas where there was potential. So we've been working with like a transformer-based approach to accelerate classification. So for example, I mentioned that we have in our historic collection a lot of like great editorially tagged items. So we're training using transformer-based approaches, training classifiers on tags. So when we are handing one of our documents over to the language model to answer the question, we're doing two things. We're saying to the model, answer the question based on this document. Mm-hmm. So the interface for engagement right now is through our dashboard. Down the road, the interface will be through our browser extension, the pop-up. So you just, anytime you see a citation, you can hover over, start talking to that case. But right now it's through the browser extension. So that gives it that context of the question that's about to come is about this document. Now, for that document in our backend, we've already indexed it. We're not grabbing that on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
We already have a copy of it. We've already broken down into fragments that the system can engage and talk to. And we've already labeled to that file other things that we know about that case. So we've labeled to that file that we happen to know that this one might deal with a particular procedural matter, or this one might deal with, you know, a particular tort and so on. It's not intended to influence the result, but it's intended to constrain the imagination of the document.
So essentially you're passing through some of the metadata that you've generated over the years as part of it, so that it does kind of put it into a framework rather than just giving it just an open text to ingest and digest itself, right?
Okay. That's right. So it will have the ability to draw on the available context should it be relevant to how the answer comes back. The idea with these language models is they can be influenced by what you let it look at. So GPT is not restricted by a database. The book version that you were talking about, it's restricted. The answer has to come from within that book.
Mm-hmm.
The answer for us has to come from within the case document. The other thing that we're doing with this that's going to be a later iteration, is to pass it back. So if a question comes in, tell me the relevant test and how this matter was argued by the plaintiff. So the answer comes back. And then we use everything else that we know, including the breakdown of the document, and we're going to map it back to where in the document we think the support for the statement came from.
That's a good idea.
So that's not part of the first iteration that's out right now, but that is something that we're incorporating into the next, which, you know, by having spent so much time analyzing these documents prior to the incorporation of a GPT type tool, it's easier for us to work our way back. Like an example of that is one of our classification models is a sentence level classifier where every sentence of every opinion is classified as one or more facts, issues, analysis, law, and conclusion.
Wow. So it's pretty granular.
It is pretty granular. And so we can group that into paragraphs and so on. So it allows us to take other NLP techniques like semantic matching and say, okay, well, the words it used is this. It was making a point, you know, in its paragraph, we can see that it's saying fact, or law analysis. Mm-hmm. So it allows us to map it back. So this is a fun time for us.
Yeah.
To all these things that we were working towards, like the power of this particular model kind of caught us off guard, but everything that we had built in the structure of the browser extension, the dashboard, the analysis, meant that this was actually quite straightforward for us to plug in and begin using.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it sounds like you had a really good baseline of work that you'd already done. And you're right, this new, especially this DaVinci 3, seems to be just leaps and bounds better than all the other models that have been out there. I know I've been, you know, significantly impressed by the whole thing on just doing some very basic stuff.
Yeah, you've been doing some interesting stuff with your automated legal tech news.
Yeah, and comic book news and all kinds of stuff.
Yep.
I've been having all kinds of fun with this, and I think, you know, this is a geek's dream of having a tool that can really kind of inspire people to come up with, you know, unique ways to play with information.
And, yes.
And like I said, when you told me that you were already working on this project, I was like, well, I have to learn more about this.
One thing that we have going for us is my co-founder in this, his name's Giuliano Robello. He's been working in AI in one capacity or another for the past 20 years. For the past 4 years, he's been working in legal AI and explainable AI, and also been working with universities and managing an annual national competition on what's called legal information extraction and entailment.
Mm.
So this is solidly in his domain. So when we build these models, we build them in a way that we're not dependent on, in this case, the OpenAI GPT. It's actually set up in a way that if we decide we like what Google comes out with next better, we swap out the DaVinci API call and swap in something else. Mm. There's an incredible company that in Toronto called Cohere. It was founded
Yes.
by a guy named Aidan Gomez, who was one of the original authors of the Transformer paper at Google that sort of led us to BERT and everything else.
Right.
And so we've been working with their APIs as well, too. So we see this as something that can get better. You know, it becomes a tool. So it's, let's just call it a really, really, really powerful wrench.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have to change our entire garage based on the wrench we choose. We can find the right wrench for the things that we're trying to achieve.
Right. Yeah. It's almost like an impact wrench where, yeah, it does exactly what, you know, a regular wrench would do, only faster and stronger. Right.
So I like that. And also it's a point of sadness in me that I've never actually owned an impact wrench. I've had times where I've wanted one, but I've never owned one.
It's too powerful for me. I'll do the AI, but I'm not going to use an impact wrench. So let me ask you, who are you thinking is going to be the consumer for this type of product?
When we were pulling it together, so a little over a year ago, we had a proof of concept thing that we started bringing back to lawyers, law librarians, and others to say, here's what we think we're going to build. What do you think about it? And then from that, it really became obvious to us that this is a tool that you almost have like a consumer level engagement with of the individual user, because they're going to have a personalized experience with it. So a junior attorney is going to engage with this to explore new and unfamiliar areas more quickly. A senior attorney is going to refresh their knowledge. One of the key questions we ask people is assume that if we build this, your law firm will not pay for it. Your university will not pay for it. Your government department or legal department will not pay for it. Would you reach into your own pocket, pull out your credit card and use it? Having heard enough yeses, we went ahead and built it. But from a marketing perspective, that's who we think it's going to be, the person who wants to solve their own problem by making this a web-based overlay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that needs to go through a purchasing. It's a very personal experience that we're creating for individuals. Okay. And so,
is the consumer going to be in the Canadian legal market, or do you see it expanding beyond that at some point?
Well, everything that we've built, we've ensured performs equally well on U.S. data as well as Canadian data.
Okay.
So we have the advantage in Canada of having had a data set. We have opportunities in the U.S. built around availabilities of different quality data sets. So our initial build was on top of the Court Listener data set. So we've incorporated a lot of that, and we've been doing our testing on that. Whether it becomes our permanent data set, we're chatting with different folks to figure out the right way to incorporate the U.S. content in there. But it's very much something that's targeted to the entirety of Canada, U.S., not Mexico yet. But okay. we've also done a lot of testing on UK and Australia and other Commonwealth judgments. Right now, for the first half of this year, we're about 75-80% focused on Canada. The chat function is going to be available on the Canadian data next week, so roughly from the 20th, February 20th.
Okay.
The U.S. data will be available likely in March.
Awesome.
Through that model. We're a finalist at the ABA Tech Show's Startup Alley. So we better not, you know, show up in that house and not have an offering for U.S. attorneys.
Yeah, that's you got to read the room there, and that's going to be American lawyers looking for American law. So I'm glad you see that.
Yeah, no, we absolutely see it. But what's fun is American lawyers occasionally get exposed to Canadian law and vice versa,
mm-hmm.
and by analyzing both, we can actually provide access to the other country's content to people when they come across it in a judgment.
Yeah. Well, and you've been working on this for, you said, well over a year, right? I mean, this is
yes.
And what, you know, I don't want to take any intellectual property from you, and so just limit this to what you can say, but what other kind of concepts are you thinking about that you can use a tool like this to help you create beyond, you know, kind of the junior attorney interpret this case and give me a summary? What other concepts are out there that you're thinking of?
From the perspective of serving the individual attorney, the natural evolution is into a word add-in. Everything about the way we set up could quite easily be turned into a word add-in. So the engagement becomes an analysis not of what you've been reading, but of what you've been writing.
Mm.
And an easier pathway into that. So you can expect that later this year. I don't think we're giving away any secrets and suggesting that we want to be where lawyers live, but we're not jumping into Outlook or to email, because we want to be where they're engaging with the content.
Right.
And that is in their research tools and where they write. The other aspect that this is all set up, we've been building it all as background APIs that feed our own services, which means they can feed other services. So everything that we do to analyze what we call a rhetorical legal document. Now, rhetorical just being it's not a contract. It's something where someone's actually arguing and making a case. So that includes briefs. It includes legal memos, demand letters, and so on. So our models are capable of analyzing that material inside databases. So if integration partners want to point our models to enhance the metadata associated with the content already in their systems, that is an evolution of what our tools were built to accomplish.
Okay.
And then the other thing that sort of flows naturally from that, we're having conversations with a couple different integration partners where they're engaging with user content already through browser extensions and word add-ins, but we can layer in extra information for them. So that way the user doesn't have to rely on two separate browser extensions to accomplish something if we just piggyback our capabilities and feed it into an interface that they want. Our philosophy behind all of this, it sort of goes to the same reason we started with this idea of synthesis and reading rather than search, is no one really wants to change the first step of the research process.
Right.
If you like Westlaw, you're going to stay with Westlaw. If you like fast case, you're going to stay with fast case. If you like Canva, you're going to stay with Canva. So we believe the same thing applies to document management services and so on.
Okay.
So in a lot of those places, it's not the goal to replace the first step, but it's the goal to enhance the second step when you start engaging. And so integration partners will be better suited to incorporate that than we will to create a new interface.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I've been using the term, and it may not be the exact right term to use, but it's tools like this I see as more of an augmentation of what you're doing. Yep. And so I saw Casey Flaherty had tweeted something out earlier that we want to have a legitimate conversation around what this is doing. And when you start the conversation with saying, this is going to replace lawyers, or on the other end, this is a, you know, terrible thing. It will never, you know, never be able to even write documents. Both of those extremes just really aren't a starting point in the conversation. And so using it as an augmentation, I love that you talked about using it for synthesis and reading and not for search. That's another way that, you know, I think most people are like, well, it can't do search. And it was like, yeah, that's not what it's set up to do. That's not the, you know, if you want, there's great search tools out there.
That's right.
You know, this is much more that synthesis and reading. I think you're the first person I heard say that straight like that.
Yeah, exactly. When Westlaw announced Precision, they really emphasized the amount of work that they put into improving the quality of your search results.
Right.
But the experience of when you start opening up documents is relatively unchanged and potentially worse. And this isn't a knock against Westlaw. This is just the reality of the framing of how a legal research tool operates, is that they have a way of presenting. And frankly, it would be dangerous for them to change that. Like, right. We have the benefit of starting with zero customers. Well, that's not entirely true. We've actually had a really positive growth in our pre-sale. But can you imagine starting with hundreds of thousands of customers and you change something?
Because you know how much lawyers love change.
They all love change, but they're not going to come up and pat Westlaw on the back for saying, we're really glad you changed the search interface.
Yeah.
You changed the next step. We're really glad I have to learn something new.
And again, I think whether it's what you're doing, or another example would be like what Docket Alarm is doing with giving the three bullet points on a docket sheet. That's an add-in. That's an additional thing that doesn't replace what the core part of the business is.
That's right.
And maybe at some point it does, but for right now, I think, you know, it's incremental change. It's you know, testing things out as you go and kind of testing the limits of what a product like this will do.
It also represents a part of what people are looking for. Again, they don't want to keep opening tab after tab after tab. They don't want another document. They want the information inside the document. Mm-hmm. When they already know they're at a document that's useful, the next step is, how do we get that information out? You mentioned Casey, like, honestly, one of the guiding principles of us setting this up was something that the Lex Fusion, when they did their 2,600 interviews of clients and they put out their initial report, I can't get the quote exactly right, but it was something to the effect of, make it easier, make it better, but don't make me learn.
Mm,
and okay. So
Casey said it in a 5,000 word document. That's the same thing.
Yeah. Well, he was sucking that point. He was summarizing the feedback that they received. But the message that we took is, okay, that's the standard we have to achieve. What can we do without actually requiring training? Can people hover over a link? Yes.
Good. Yeah. What are some of the limitations that you're running into?
One of the nice things, and one of the reasons we didn't pursue this earlier, was cost was a significant limitation. Mm-hmm. So in fall of last year, OpenAI reduced the prices of its DaVinci APIs, and that made a big difference to moving us down the path of making this available, because it is a challenge. Even if you're just talking pennies an engagement, you still have to say, well, what if there are 100,000 engagements or 200,000?
I was going to say, anyone that's had to pay a large law firm's Pacer account knows those pennies add up.
That's right. So having enough confidence that we can plan for that and do this effectively. So one of the ways that we're approaching that on the Canadian side is, the volume of published case law is sufficiently small that we're actually going to pre-process, using MyJunior, against a half dozen summarization questions, every case that comes out of the courts, and then make it available as a mailing service. So free daily case summaries, choose your court, choose your topic, choose your summary style. And then those inside our dashboard become, you know, here's some recommended previews. And so you can say, here are six different ways I could summarize this case. Let me pick one. But it will be now a cached answer because we'll have already processed it. So planning for cost is a big one. And then also the next big challenge is, stand-up comics in the 90s always saying that they would get offers for sitcoms. Oh, you're great at stand-up, but can you act?
Right.
You know, so we're getting the equivalent of, this is really cool. Can I do these next 10 things? Well, maybe at some point, if there's a logical path for growth. So constraining our own enthusiasm and those of our prospective customers is actually a challenge, because everything else we've done up to this point has been trying to concentrate on what we can do in a way that attorneys can trust the result. Mm. So that exuberance of not breaking that commitment, say, you can trust the result because of what we put in. So it doesn't matter that, frankly, and I wish and I hope and I expect, you know, dozens of other companies are going to stick a ChatGPT interface on top of the free law, and they're going to do lots of amazing stuff, and it's going to create a different level of expectations, but they're not committing to that idea of trust. So that is a challenge for us too, is to make sure that we keep pace with the market's desire to go further, but without sort of breaking that initial commitment that will give you stuff that you know you can rely on.
Yeah.
Well, I think Docket Alarm. Yeah, the Docket Alarm approach is a good example of keeping that kind of commitment, because they're saying, look, we'll give you the 3-point summarization of this to help you decide if you should check.
Right.
That is something that they can, with confidence, say, we're delivering what we said we're gonna deliver for the purpose that we said we're going to do. So I think as people approach it that way, that's the right way to approach it.
I know things are changing very quickly. I mean, 3 months ago, we weren't talking about this, and now it's all we're talking about. But I want you to pull out your crystal ball here and kind of let me know, where do you think the legal industry is headed when it comes to tools like this and resources like you are setting up?
I believe that by the end of this year, so I'm going to give you my short term and then a bit of a long term, but by the end of 2023, I do believe the idea of proceeding without some sort of tool that can serve as not necessarily a colleague, but some form of check tool, engagement tool that allows you to test ideas and test theories, first drafts and so on. I think that's going to become pretty commonplace. It's going to move, I think, more quickly on the transactional side, not on whole documents, but on portions of documents, on first drafts. We've never seen this before from the legal community having the same level of enthusiasm for a piece of tech as the community at large, as we're seeing here.
Right.
We've never seen the complaints that people offer online as being, I'm disappointed that it didn't do this tiny little narrow thing correctly when it did all this amazing stuff correctly. So that kind of adoption of that kind of tool, it's not necessarily going to be from legal tech companies. If Microsoft is incorporating GPT into its core products, then it becomes an expectation that you're going to have some ability to engage with information other than traditional search. And so that, for the future beyond 2023, really opens it up. It really opens up our collective imagination for the parts of our system that we can change. I met somebody this morning who believes that there's a significant portion of transactional work that's, you know, anything built around forms to government bodies has to move away from work done by lawyers. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of that is going to happen. And I think the acceptance of it is going to surprise us.
Yeah.
Like how ready people are for that to happen.
Okay. Anything longer term?
Longer term, I think about the movie Her with, you know, the Joaquin Phoenix.
Yes.
you know, a movie Her where eventually the machines are so smart they get bored of us and they leave.
Well, and it's kind of unfair for me to answer my own question here, but that's never stopped me before. But my guess is that somewhere along the line, and we saw just a glimpse of this last week when Google did their Bard demo, which was a canned demo. and they lost like 7% of their value, over $100 billion of value in just a few minutes. I think we have to be careful that the worst thing that could happen is that somebody relies upon this and it causes a client to lose their business or a law firm to go under. No one wants to be embarrassed and no one wants to lose money. I'd say that's, the two things. And it's always some event happens. It could be, and we've seen it, a crash in the dot-com market, 9/11, the big, the Great Recession, things like COVID. There may be other things that slow the process down, but I think we're definitely, and you were right, I've never seen the legal industry jump on something as quickly as it's jumped on this. And so I think, and I think it's got some traction.
It's got traction. Yeah, but I agree that there's some serious risks. And I think there's a role for responsible, trusted players to show leadership. People ask, you're running this as a startup. Aren't you concerned about what the larger guys will do? And I said, there's nothing that we can do technically that they can't.
Right.
They absolutely can. So I really encourage them to find the elements that they want to showcase, that they want to help move the industry forward on. As a startup, we pick an entry point and we grow from there. But they ultimately are the ones who are going to turn the dial. Yeah. Them and government.
Yeah, that's the government and the bar associations. Don't underestimate their ability to throw the monkey wrench into the works on that as well.
I suppose.
Well, Colin LaChance, CEO and co-founder of JurisAge AI, thank you very much for taking the time to come on and talk with us. I'm as excited, I think, as you are about the potential for this.
Great. Thank you, Greg. I appreciate it.
All right. And of course, thanks to everyone listening for tuning in to the Geek and Review podcast. If you enjoy the show, share it with a colleague. We would love to hear from you. So reach out to us on social media. I can be reached at Glambert on Twitter, and Marlene can be reached at GabeBauerM on Twitter. Colin, how can we reach out to you?
I'm on Twitter. I spend too much time on Twitter. It's at Colin LaChance, ColinLaChance. ANCE.
All right.
Same on LinkedIn.
Yeah, we'll make sure that we put that in the show notes, along with information out to both my junior and to JurisAge. Or if you're not into all this advanced AI and you want to pick up the phone and give us a call, you can leave us a message on our Geek and Review hotline at 713-487-7821. And as always, the music you hear is from Jerry David DeSica. Thank you, Jerry. Thanks again, Colin.
Thanks, Greg.
Devil's back.